From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This can be classified certainly as partly a civil rights demonstration, but I think it emulates from individuals in the community who are more concerned about themselves, perhaps, than they are concerned about doing something in relationship to civil rights.
40 years ago, Newark erupted.
A year or two.
Coming weeks.
They will never say riot again, that it was a rebellion. And that we have to remember that it was a rebellion, because when you say riot, it diminishes the struggle, the historic nature of our struggle.
Amiri Baraka was beaten almost unconscious by New Jersey police. He joins us in our Firehouse studio live with Larry Hamm. As Newark quieted down, Detroit erupted. We'll go there to speak with lifelong activist Grace Lee Boggs at 92. Her memory is still fresh. 43 people were killed in Detroit, 26 in Newark. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House has approved a measure that would begin withdrawing combat troops from Iraq within the next 3 months. The final vote was 223 to 201, mostly along party lines. Before the vote, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi urged lawmakers to vote yes.
Let us pass this bill and those that will follow in the coming weeks and provide the new direction on Iraq that the American people demand, and that is so urgently needed. I urge a yes vote on the Skelton bill.
Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich was the lone anti-war Democrat to vote against the bill. The measure would remove most combat troops by April of next year, but still leaves tens of thousands of soldiers behind. The House vote came hours before President Bush released an interim progress report that says the Iraqi government has failed to meet most key benchmarks set by Congress. These include the passage of a U.S.-backed oil law heavily criticized by Iraqi unions. Speaking at the White House, Bush dismissed recent polls showing 70% of Americans back a withdrawal and called on Congress to continue funding the war. The president also repeated his erroneous linkage of the Iraq war to 9/11.
The same folks that are bombing innocent people in Iraq were the ones who attacked us in America on September the 11th. And that's why what happens in Iraq matters to the security here at home.
Bush also addressed his commuting of the sentence of former Vice President Dick Cheney, Louis Scooter Libby. For the first time, the president publicly acknowledged someone in his administration likely leaked the name of CIA operative Valerie Plame. But Bush called his decision, quote, fair and balanced, and said he's moving on.
I'm aware of the fact that perhaps somebody in the administration did disclose the name of that person. And, you know, I've often thought about what would have happened had that person come forth and said, I did it. Would we have had this, you know, endless hours of investigation and a lot of money being spent on this matter? And it's been a tough issue for a lot of people in the White House, and it's run its course, and now we're going to move on.
In news from Iraq, at least 16 people were killed Thursday in clashes between U.S. troops and Shia militias in Baghdad. The dead included a photographer for the Reuters news agency and his driver. They apparently came under fire from a U.S. helicopter. This is an unidentified witness.
The U.S. soldiers randomly fired on cars and children. Even journalists were not safe. Over here was a Reuters crew.
Residents say the remaining dead were civilians, including at least two children. An Agence France-Presse journalist who interviewed witnesses on the scene said the helicopter appeared to indiscriminately fire on any gathering of people in the area. Privacy concerns are being raised over a U.S. military program that's taking fingerprints and eye scans from thousands of Iraqi men and inputting them into a Pentagon database. USA Today reports Iraqis have been stopped at checkpoints, workplaces, and sites of attacks and scanned by U.S. troops. Between 5,000 to 10,000 Baghdad residents have been scanned since March. Iraqis face being barred from their neighborhoods if they refuse the biometric scans. In other Iraq news, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has issued an urgent appeal for more funding to aid Iraqi refugees. Nearly 4 million Iraqis have been internally displaced or have left Iraq. The UN says that number is growing by around 2,000 people fleeing their homes each day. In campaign news, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton and former Senator John Edwards have been caught discussing an apparent plan to exclude other Democratic candidates from future debates. On Thursday, Edwards and Clinton were speaking privately after an NAACP presidential forum in Detroit. Unaware their microphones were still on, Edwards is overheard saying, quote, "We should try to have a more serious and a smaller group." Clinton agreed, responding, quote, "We've got to cut the number. They're not serious." Clinton also indicated the two had discussed the plan before, telling Edwards, "We've got to get back to it." In response, Ohio Congressmember and Democratic candidate Dennis Kucinich said, quote, "No matter how important or influential they perceive themselves to be, candidates do not have and should not have the power to determine who is allowed to speak to the American public and who is not. Imperial candidates are as repugnant to the American people and to our democracy as an imperial president." In other Iraq news, or campaign news, the nation's largest union of firefighters has released a new video urging members not to support the campaign of former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. It's called Rudy Giuliani, Urban Legend. The International Association of Firefighters video criticizes Giuliani's handling of the 9/11 aftermath.
We did need radios that worked. We didn't have them. We did need proper respiratory protection. He didn't give it to us. The things that we needed to do our job even better, we didn't have because of his administration.
So ultimately, the mayor of New York at the time, Mr. Giuliani, he has to bear these responsibilities.
And I blame Giuliani. He was the leader that day. And he was the leader for the 8 years leading up to that.
I wish I could put him on the stand where he'd have to put his hand on the Bible and swear to tell the truth.
He's not a leader. He's running on 9/11, and it's all a fallacy.
The video blames Giuliani for faulty equipment that hindered the recovery and accuses him of prioritizing a search for bank-owned gold buried beneath the rubble over recovering the remains of the victims. In Somalia, at least 3 people were killed and 13 wounded as heavy shelling hit the capital, Mogadishu. The fighting comes ahead of a government-backed reconciliation conference set for this weekend. This is Dr. Hassan Osman Isse, manager of the Medina Hospital.
Until this morning, we received 24 wounded civilians. 7 of them were seriously injured. These days, we expect at least 40 casualties daily.
Somalia has seen intense clashes and fighting between U.S.-backed Ethiopian and Somali forces against Islamic clerics. In Mexico, a federal court has suspended the genocide trial against former President Luis Echeverria. Echeverria was accused over his alleged role in the 1968 Tlatelolco massacre of student protesters in Mexico City. He was interior minister at the time and has been accused of ordering government forces to open fire. The killings occurred 10 days before Mexico hosted the Olympic Games. Human rights groups estimate up to 300 people were killed. In Peru, hundreds of people gathered outside the Chilean embassy on Thursday to protest a Chilean Supreme Court rejection of an extradition request for former Peruvian president Alberto Fujimori. Fujimori faces several corruption and human rights charges, including the killing of political opponents, illegal phone tapping, and bribery. Protester Gisela Ortiz lost family members under the Fujimori regime. On Thursday, she criticized Chilean Judge Orlando Alvarez for his decision.
What Dr. Alvarez has done not only shows a lack of familiarity with the cases of human rights violations, but it also shows the political arrangement the Chilean government has to avoid fighting with Japan over the issue of Fujimori.
The extradition request will now go before a second Chilean Supreme Court hearing, which will have final say. Back in the United States, the House Judiciary Subcommittee has moved towards beginning contempt proceedings against former White House counsel Harriet Myers. She refused to appear before a congressional hearing on the firing of U.S. attorneys after President Bush invoked executive privilege to prevent her testimony. In Georgia, the prosecutor behind the controversial jailing of Gennaro Wilson is facing allegations of distributing child pornography in his effort to keep Wilson behind bars. Wilson is an African-American serving a 10-year prison sentence for having consensual oral sex with another teenager. He was 17 years old at the time. The girl was 15 years old when the sexual encounter took place. Wilson was convicted of felony aggravated child molestation. He's already spent 2 years behind bars. This week, District Attorney David McDade distributed some 35 copies of video allegedly showing the teen's sexual encounter. Earlier this week, Georgia's chief federal prosecutor, David Namias, said the video constitutes child pornography and called on McDade to stop releasing copies. Namias did not rule out bringing criminal charges over McDade's actions. In addition to releasing the tapes, he did not obscure the faces of the females to obscure their identity and did not try to keep the material under seal. And finally, back at the White House, President Bush reverted to a presidential press conference tradition he has long ignored, giving the first question to veteran correspondent Helen Thomas.
And now I'll be glad to answer a few questions, starting with Ms. Thomas.
President, you started this war, the war of your choosing, and you can end it alone today. At this point, bring in peacekeepers, UN peacekeepers. 2 million Iraqis have fled the country as refugees. 2 million more are displaced. Thousands and thousands are dead. Don't you understand? We brought the Al-Qaeda into Iraq.
I was hoping to solve the Iraqi issue diplomatically. That's why I went to the United Nations and worked with the United Nations Security Council, which unanimously passed a resolution that said disclose, disarm, or face serious consequences. That was the message, a clear message, to Saddam Hussein. He chose the course. It was his decision to make. Obviously, it was a difficult decision for me to make.
Being questioned by Helen Thomas. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Well, 40 years ago, Newark erupted, followed by Detroit, then city after city across the United States exploded in spontaneous uprisings by disaffected American, African-American communities who were met with brutal violence by police and National Guardsmen. In Newark, 26 people were killed and 43 were killed in Detroit. Thousands more were injured. At the height of the Detroit Rebellion on July 28, 1967, President Johnson appointed the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders to investigate the root causes of the unrest. The final report, known as the Kerner Commission, famously concluded that the United States was, quote, moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal.
Today, on the 40th anniversary of the Newark Rebellion, we go back to the tumultuous days of July 1967. We'll speak with Amiri Baraka and Larry Hamm. Amiri Baraka is a renowned poet, playwright and activist who is a native of Newark. He was one of the founders of the Black Arts Movement in the 60s and was New Jersey's Poet Laureate in 2002. In 1967, he was arrested and severely beaten by the police during the rebellion. Larry Hamm is a longtime community organizer in Newark and chair of the People's Organization for Progress. It organizes a commemoration of the Newark Rebellion every year. He was 13 years old at the time of the rebellion. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Let's go back to those days. Amiri Baraka, where were you?
You mean when I was arrested?
July 12th, it all began. This is July 13th, Exactly 40 years after. When were you beaten by police? And explain the background of what happened.
Yeah, we were demonstrating in front of the 4th Precinct, where we had a gathering yesterday, and we were demonstrating in the demonstration, which Bob Kirvin and Cora led, I walked home down Springfield Avenue from there and around the corner to my house, which is right next to the Newark courthouse. By the time I got to where I was living and sitting on the porch, kids ran up and said they're breaking out windows around the corner. I jumped in my car, with two other friends of mine, and we drove right around the corner. And by the time we got into, up to, you know, Belmont Avenue, it was on. People were breaking out windows. There were already fires. And the police, you could see the police circling. So we were driving through in and out, zigzagging through these streets, looking, you know, seeing what was happening.
How did it all erupt? How did it all begin before July 12th?
Well, see, if you want to talk about that, I said yesterday, you have to start with slavery, because those abuses have never been eradicated. You know, people are not living in slums because they voted to. You know, their children are not in jail because they wanted them to. You know, these are the results of a people who've been oppressed and suffer national oppression, you know. And so in a city like Newark, which is the third oldest city in the United States, by the way, where all these kind of abuses sort of converge, you know, and the racism on top of that, you know. I mean, one absurd example is one time I was directing a play, and the police rushed into the loft, and a man actually took the script out of my hand, you know, as if it was some kind of a volatile weapon, you know. So that day we had been picketing because they had beaten up a black cab driver, a guy named John Smith. But that whole month, 2 months before that, there was contentions. First, they wanted 160 acres for a medical school. We found out the biggest medical school in the United States was Johns Hopkins, which is like 1.5 acres. They wouldn't hire this guy as a, what was his name, Wilbur Parker, as the secretary of the Board of Education. Guy, what was it, a Cornell master's degree. They hired instead this one of Adnesio's cronies who had high school graduate. They had run into this Muslim dojo, you know, a karate school, and beaten up everybody there. And then the John Smith, and so they pulled him out of the car, beat him up, you know, circulated that he was dead. And so people gathered at that precinct, and then that was very explosive that night. That was the night before. That was, the 11th. So the next day, we were picketing that precinct, because that's where it happened. And that was the day, by the time the sun started going down, is when it broke out.
Now, we saw a clip of Mayor Adonisio, but could you talk a little bit about the political climate, the mayor's regime, as well as Anthony Imperiale was running around then in those days? And what was the climate that the majority population, the black community in Newark, was feeling
then?
Well,
see, first of all, when you say Adonisio, who was indicted and, you know, what was it? He was giving 1% of the city's budget to the mob.
He was the mayor.
He was the mayor, Adonisio. No-neck Adonisio. And his Spina, okay, was the... It was interesting that Spina, who was the police chief, when they beat me up, they didn't take me to prison or to the... They took me to Spina's office, you know, and threw me on the floor. And he says, you know, just like right out of the movies, they got you, you know. And I said, but I ain't dead.
He was head of police.
Yeah, yeah, he was the police chief, you know.
And they brought you to his...
To his office, not to jail. But since I had given my given name, Everett L. Jones, laborer, you know, then they could deny until my wife got hold of Ginsburg, Allen Ginsburg, and he got in hold of Jean-Paul Sartre, and Sartre called the police station.
From France?
Yeah, called the police station. Sartre and Ginsburg and those people start, you know. And then the only reason I got my life saved is the people in the apartment building where they were beating me start throwing things out of the window at them. Otherwise, I would be gone, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was a very, very, the racism that existed
by
there.
By then you were already a very well-known poet and published author.
And harassing them, you know, in that town. See, the town's too small for you to be doing something. I mean, they actually have policemen stop a poetry reading. I mean, that's how wild it was getting. They would ride up and down the street and make remarks at my wife and the other ladies in that block, calling them all kinds of slurs. I mean, this was a nightly thing. And so it became like, you know, back and forth, you know. And finally, it just erupted. We were trying to do things. We were putting out literature suggesting that we could have a mayor. Mm-hmm. We could have a city council. You know, that's Stokely had come out with Black Power, and I was staple at, not staple, what do you call it, spray paint. Black Power and all these buildings in the city, you know. So they knew who it was. And once I got arrested, they ran in my house to destroy all of the leaflets and stuff that we were. But my wife was smart enough to get that stuff out of there and move it to somebody else's house down the street. But they destroyed our mimeograph machines and stuff like that. They destroyed my car, you know. I mean, it was, you know, a search and destroy mission because they knew who it was, you know, in that little context. But the whole city, you know, as Harper's Magazine said, the worst city in the United States was Newark. 18,000 people density in 1 square mile, you know, talking about the project. So it was a city that was always on the verge, you know.
We're talking to Amiri Baraka. When we come back, we'll also talk to Larry Hamm, well-known community organizer, who was 13 at the time of the rebellion. After the Newark rebellion died down, Detroit erupted. We'll go to Detroit to speak with Grace Lee Boggs. But we'll also hear from family members in Newark of those who lost loved ones. Ultimately, 26 people died in the rebellion of Newark. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
From the Indians, welcome the pilgrims, and to the buffaloes who once ruled the plain. Like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain. Looking for the rain. Just like the cities that stagger on the coastline, and a nation that just can't stand much more. Like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. Winter in America. Yes, and all of the hills have been killed, sent away. Yeah, but the people know it's winter. Winter in America.
Gil Scott-Heron singing Winter in America. That's Winter in America, and it was Winter in America in the summer of 19, the summer that Newark erupted in 1967. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our guest in studio in New York. Our Amiri Baraka, poet, playwright, activist, beaten almost unconscious, then taken to the office of the police commissioner in Newark by the Newark police in the midst of the uprising, one of the founders of the black arts movements in the 60s. He was New Jersey's poet laureate as well. Larry Hamm is with us, community organizer in Newark, chair of the People's Organization for Progress, that year after year has organized a commemoration of the Newark Rebellion. We went out to the commemoration yesterday. Larry Hamm, you were 13 yes. when the uprising took place.
Yes. Believe it or not, I was at a party across the street from my house that evening. Some folks ran upstairs and said, Springfield Avenue is on fire. And we all ran out the house, ran down the stairs. We were getting ready to run down 12th Street. We were running down 12th Street. But my mother, we lived across the street. She was on the porch. She says, you're not going down the Springfield Avenue. And she probably saved my life by doing so. But it was a cataclysmic event I'll never forget. I mean, I think it was the event that shaped my life. I came from a regular kind of working class family. My father's a truck driver. He passed away. We went to live with my grandparents. My grandfather was a boiler man. My mother was a seamstress. We didn't talk about politics too much, but after the rebellion broke out, that all changed. It was like our political awakening, or my political awakening. Our community was under military occupation. We could stand out on our second floor porch and look out and see everything that was going on. Sometimes it was festive with the looting, but then sometimes it was outright violent. And people were stoning cars that were trying to move into the white community and so forth. And then the guard came in, and then we were literally under military occupation. They had, like, set up posts on either end of our street. I lived a block and a half from Springfield Avenue. For 3 days, we were under, more than 3 days, I think we were under martial law. We couldn't leave our house. And then when it was lifted and we had to go out and get food, because people couldn't get food. The stores were looted. You didn't have no food. And they would search our cars going in and search our cars going out. The guard would go door to door looking for contraband. And it's funny because I remarked to you yesterday, I can relate to probably what the people in Gaza are going through and in other countries are going through, because we know what military occupation is all about. But that rebellion changed the course of history of the city and probably impacted the nation. 2 weeks after the rebellion, even though I was a young person, I know this now, I didn't know it then, but 2 weeks after the rebellion, Black Power Conference was held. A year later, the Black Political Convention was held at West Kenny Junior High School. We were just a block away from that
in Newark.
West Kenny Junior High School. Mm-hmm. In Newark, and a year after that, 1969, was a Black and Puerto Rican political convention. And a Community's Choice team came out of that, and Ken Gibson was on that team, Sharp James,
the mayor,
Dennis.
The next mayor.
Yes, Dennis Westbrooks. Gibson became mayor in 1970, and in 1971, he appointed me to the Newark Board of Education, and I became the youngest voting school board member in the history of the country.
You were a high school student.
I was 17 years old, just like four years after the rebellion. I had just graduated from high school. I wasn't even old enough to vote. But the rebellion stirred up everything. There were all kind of movements in Newark. And there was a student movement, and there was a teacher strike. And the teacher strike was the longest teacher strike in the history of the country. We thought we weren't going to graduate. So all the high school students, we got together. We formed an organization. We marched on the board and the teachers union. They were negotiating at the Gateway Hotel in 1971, and 200 of us took over two floors of the Gateway Hotel and had a sit-in. We said we weren't leaving until the mayor came. That's when I met Ken Gibson. And it was just a couple of months after that, he appointed me to the Newark Board of Education.
So, in essence, what you're saying is that the rebellion itself sparked the political political awakening in Newark. And Newark, in effect, wasn't Gibson the first Black mayor of a major American city?
He was of a major East Coast city.
Right.
Yes, yes. And, you know, Newark was already in transition. I mean, I believe there was a Black Power Conference held in 1966. Gibson ran for mayor in 66 and lost in 66. But see, the rebellion was a thing, I think, that helped transform a lot of people's consciousness.
And yesterday was the first time a mayor, Cory Booker of Newark, walked in your commemoration march.
That is
where you marched from the 4th Precinct, from the police precinct.
That's true.
To the marker.
Well, he didn't go to the marker now. He dropped out. When we turned that corner away from the precinct, he disappeared into the mist.
Talk about that marker, Larry Hamm.
Well, everybody in Newark that was there in 67 knew that it was the seminal event. You can't understand Newark today without knowing something about 1967, and everybody felt that there should be something that would be a constant reminder of what happened. And so people asked for some kind of monument to those who perished during the rebellion. And the city council, primarily, I guess George Branch was a Central Ward councilman then, you know, facilitated the establishment of that monument, and it has the names of all 26 people on it.
Yesterday at the march, some of the family members of those who died were there.
Yes.
Crystal Spellman's mother, Eloise, was killed by gunfire from police, state troopers, National Guardsmen 40 years ago. A mother of 11, Eloise, was shot through the neck while closing the windows of her apartment in the Hayes Home Public Housing Project on July 15, 1967. This is an excerpt from a documentary made over 2 years ago. It's called Newark, more than two decades ago. It's called Newark, The Slow Road Back. It's produced by Sandra King. It aired last night on New Jersey Network on PBS. It includes Crystal Spellman describing her relief at seeing her old project building destroyed as she recalls what happened to her mother.
When they blew up the projects, or some of them, I felt good and relieved that these buildings won't be there anymore, so I wouldn't have to watch them every time I drove down the street or drove down Springfield Avenue. I wouldn't have to watch these buildings and remember what happened, you know, to my family. My mother had 11 children. We all lived in the project. My mother was killed in the 1967 riots. She was shot twice. From what I understand, she was closing the window, and they shot her. They thought that she was a sniper, and they shot her. The way the sofa was set up in the living room, you know, the sofa was by the window, and of course she fell back on the sofa.
You saw that?
Yeah, I saw that. I can remember that. I remember all the blood. I remember you can take the pillow and the couch and just do like this to it, and the blood would all come out. I remember that.
That was Crystal Spellman from the New Jersey Network Sandra King documentary. There was also someone else who talked yesterday. His name was Ernest Rutledge, and he was talking about his brother, James Rutledge. James Rutledge is someone a lot of people refer to. James Rutledge, the man who was shot 39 times. How did that happen, Amiri Baraka? And how significant was that moment?
Well, they claimed that James Rutledge was looting this bar, Joe Ray's Tavern on Bergen Street. You know, his relatives obviously, you know, said another thing happened. He was in the store hiding, you know, and then he came out because the stuff had been done. You know, the place had been looted already. He told a couple of his companions to hide, and then he stood up, and they asked him, was anybody else there? And he said, no, then they shot him. But what was the most brutal thing is that he had four shots in the top of his head. I got hold of these autopsy pictures from a law student, you know, Junius Williams, and I proceeded to distribute the pictures all over the city. You know, we made copies of them, and they tried to indict me. Not the people who shot this boy, but they want to indict me for distributing the flicks. But if you saw those flicks, they are so horrific. You know what I mean? You see anybody shot in the top of their head, they're not even shot running. You know, they wasn't running. You know what I mean? They had actually, he was down and they put the gun to his head and blew holes in the top of his skull.
So let's go for a minute to Ernest Rutledge, remembering that moment. He was speaking to us yesterday in Newark, right next to the tombstone.
Yeah.
That honors the 26 people who died in Newark.
He was killed in the riots of 67, or the rebellion, they say, of 67, but it was, he was in a tavern on Bergen Street, Bergen and Custer, and the state troopers told everybody just to get off the streets, and so everybody was running for cover because they were shooting like crazy, and him and two of the boys that we grew up with, their name was Hatcher. They ran into this tavern that had already been looted and everything. And in fact, I, as a plumber, I own a plumbing business, I got a chance to work in that tavern. And as I put the boiler in, I put a very large boiler in the basement and installed it. I looked up at the ceiling, the ceiling of the basement with the floor of the tavern in the back part of it, where my brother was killed. When I got through, I went upstairs and I looked around where he looked at and where the boys told me that they hid and stayed down behind that bar and would not move. My brother told him when the state troopers came in, they asked him, who came in here with you? And he said, no one. And my brother told him, don't say nothing. And at that time, the state troopers, they started shooting him, and they reloaded their guns three times, and they kept shooting. That's how many holes my brother. My brother had so many holes in his body. Until at his funeral, you could see the circles, the rings and everything. with the bullets all in his neck, all back here, everywhere. And Mr. Perry, Orlando, he told us to get back because, and they put a barrier off, so he said because his body could collapse at any time. And my mother said to Mr. Perry, and she goes, my arm, I never forget that. She said, Mr. Perry, how many holes did my son have in him? He said, Miss Rutledge, we at 39, we stopped counting. That's how many holes my brother's body had in him. And then I saw a picture of my brother on a slab with so many holes all over his body. This incident, my mother became, she had a nervous breakdown, she became paranoid, and then above all, she became schizophrenic, and she had to be institutionalized behind this incident. And then I had to spread my wings to raise my other 12 siblings. So.
And the top of his head?
And the top of his head and all over his body. His face. What we saw, they had the makeup, couldn't cover up the holes. You could see the little dark rings and everything. It was that bad.
How old were you?
I was 17 and my brother was 19.
Ernest Rutledge remembering his brother James. There were no indictments. Juan?
Mary, the ferocity of the way the National Guard and state troopers and the police attempted to put down the rebellion. Could you talk a little bit about the white-black relations in the city? And I mentioned before Anthony Imperiale, who, for people who are younger, who was Imperiale and what did he represent in terms of race relations in the Northeast?
Imperiale was just a kind of a hoodlum who seized on that time to become the mouth of racist reaction. That's what he was. And he issued this statement with himself holding this rifle. If the Black Panther comes, the white hunter is waiting, you know. But we took that
he
photograph.
Was what, he was a councilman at the time?
He got to be a councilman later as a result of that, mm-hmm. You see. Even later, he became a state official. But we took this photograph of him holding this rifle with his stomach, where he had this huge stomach sticking out. And when we ran Gibson for mayor, we distributed these photos of him holding the rifle and said, would you want this for a mayor? But Imperiale was he was a pawn, you know, he was a mouthpiece. Actually, when we tried to build this Coweta Towers, Imperiale was making noise, so we bribed him. You know, he said, look, what do you want, Tony? We'll give you jobs, blah, 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 just shut up. And he was cooled out, but it was this Stephen Adubato who emerged as the power broker. It was Steve Adubato who was behind, actually, the opposition, the behind-the-scene opposition to Coweta Towers, so that they, we spent $1 million to make a hole for the building, and then we spent $2 million to cover the hole. So it was a $3 million nothing, you know. But that kind of rabid reaction, first of all, a lot of the white folks were moving, you know, out of there. That's why the North Ward, which was once a solid Italian community, is now a solid Latino community. As a matter of fact, and then they started to actually set fire to the Latinos' homes then. And that's when, you know, Felipe Luciano, Ramon Rivera, and I made this mutual defense pact. We called a press conference and say, you know, any violence against the Afro-American community is, you know, violence against the Puerto Rican community. Any violence against the Puerto Rican community is violence against the Afro-American community. So Imperiale sends a telegram to the governor and asks, is that legal? I mean, that's kind of mental, the kind of mental midget he was, you know what I'm saying? But that was the kind of energy, because we thought we were fighting directly against oppression. That was a war. And what Larry says, Adimu, right, I named him, but what that meant is that this war had finally materialized wholly. We had been fighting it verbally, but when they started shooting, and it was, you say, the rebellion. The people had stopped breaking in store windows and stuff after the first couple of days. But that's when the murders started, you see. When you put that under martial law, you see, my wife, you know, of course, I was locked up, but she went back to the house, and we had just been married about a year, right? And the little baby we had, Obalaji, she took him up to the third floor and got in the closet and closed the door. She had a pot of lye with some, she had a pot of hot water lye and some alligator syrup there, a little
ghetto napalm.
Napalm. And she was sitting there with the child in there, because they were running up and down, you know, like trying to destroy our house, you know.
You talked about Edimu, who you named Larry Hamm. Your name, Amiri Baraka. You were born Everett Jones, became Leroy Jones, then Amiri Baraka. Why?
No, I was Everett Leroy Jones. My grandfather's name was Everett. He was a politician in that town. My family came to Newark in the 20s. We've been there a long, long time. My father's name was Leroy, you know. The Frenchified aspect of it, because his first name was Coyette. You see, they come from South Carolina, you see. I changed my name when we became aware of the African Revolution and the whole question of our African roots. I was named by the man who buried Malcolm X, Hisham Jabir, who died last week. He named me Amir Barakat, but that's Arabic. I brought it down into Swahili land, into Tanzania, which is an accent. So it's Amiri instead of Amir, and, you know, Baraka rather than Barakat, you know, which is interesting. If it was Amir Barakat, I'd probably have more difficulty flying these days.
We're going to... Yes, sir.
And it was after the Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana, in 1972, which was like another seminal event coming out of the period of the rebellions. I was one of the youngest delegates to Gary in 1972. It was after Gary that I asked Amiri Baraka to give me an African name, because that was another transforming event for me, to see Black people coming together in a great act of self-determination.
And you also led the anti-apartheid movement at Princeton University, but that's another story for another show. We're talking to Amiri Baraka and Larry Hamm. When we come back from break, we will also be joined by Grace Lee Boggs. As Newark quieted down, Detroit erupted. So we're going to Detroit. Stay with us. City Blues here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on PBS and public access TV stations, as well as both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. And our headlines are also available in Spanish in audio and transcript form for any radio station to take. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Joining us from Detroit is Grace Lee Boggs, philosopher and activist who's lived in Detroit for 54 years. She was a central figure in the civil rights and Black liberation movements. She just turned 92 and continues to be at the forefront of struggles to rebuild communities in Detroit and rethink radical politics. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Grace Lee Boggs.
Thank you.
Tell us about Detroit 40 years ago. As Newark, the rebellion quieted down, why did Detroit erupt?
Well, Jimmy and I, my husband, my late husband Jimmy and I, were in California, actually, when Detroit exploded in July. But prior to our leaving for vacation, Jimmy had talked to the people who were with us in the city organizing committee that something was bound to happen and that we should try and stay away from it. Because there was a climate in Detroit which meant that things had to explode. Two things were happening. One, young people were being frisked and stopped and frisked by the police, whom they considered an occupation army. At the same time, beginning in the early 60s, a number of us had been saying that as the population of Detroit was becoming majority black, it was wrong for the city to be run almost exclusively by whites. The city council was almost, there was one black person on it. The school board was white. The school superintendent was white. And that was not in the tradition of cities being run by the ethnic group, which was becoming the majority. So this idea that there was a certain justice about black power and also the sense of outrage by young people at the treatment that they were given by the police. Another thing that was also happening in Detroit was that automation had come to the plants, and young people were feeling that they were being made expendable and that there was no longer any future for them. And so the rebellion was also a cry for help, for understanding by these young people that something very fundamental was happening that required change. And I think to understand the depth of the roots of what happened helps us to get beyond seeing it as a riot and helps us to see that there were issues raised there that we still face. In other words, Janara Wilson would not be criminalized for oral consensual sex with a young woman if it were not for the fact that our society does not know what to do with these young people, what perspective, what vision to offer them, and all we do is criminalize them. So we have this exploding prison population. We have the equivalent of martial law on a day-to-day, 24/7 hour basis in our cities because we have not heard the cry for help by young people in 1967.
Grace Box, I want to ask you in terms of, you mentioned the plants, and of course, a very big difference between Detroit and Newark was the enormous importance of the automobile industry to that city, the heart blood in those days of American capitalism, and many, many black workers who had moved, especially during World War II, into the plants. And there was a resurgence of a whole new radical labor movement subsequent to that, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers and other groups that developed. Could you talk about the impact of the rebellion on sort of the political consciousness of the black community?
Well, what was happening, you see, during World War II, for the first time as a result of the March on Washington of 1941, black workers had gotten jobs in the plant and had acquired enough seniority and wages to buy a home and send their kids to college, kids who became actually the SNCC activists in the civil rights movement. But this was drying up for young people. And what was in front of us was a shrinking working class rather than expanding working class. And this required a whole new concept of education. It required a whole new concept of justice. It required a whole new concept of what is the purpose of work. Detroit had been the national, international symbol of industrialization and successful industrialization for the first half of the 20th century. Now it was becoming deindustrialized, and we had not yet thought through or created the kinds of infrastructure that are needed for a deindustrializing society. For cities in the 21st century, we have to become very different from what was possible, both ecologically possible and in every other respect, during a period of expanding industry. And I think it's within that historical perspective that we have to understand 67, not only in terms of white power versus black power, or black power versus white power, but in terms of the transition that the world and the United States and Detroit in particular is undergoing. I think it's within that context that we can get beyond the criminalization, the sort of martial lawization of our society at the present time.
Grace Lee Boggs, in Newark, 26 people were killed in the rebellion, 24 of them African-American, then a fire captain and a policeman. In Detroit, 43 people were killed. How did that happen? Were there indictments? There were none in Newark.
There were not indictments. And the question of, I mean, the question, I think what I hear, Amy, is that we think that the question of justice is the question of whether we indict or whether we prosecute. And I think that we're reaching another stage where we have to see the question of justice in terms of how do we rebuild our communities, how do we restore our people, how do we, as Americans, with this terrible crisis that we're in now, not only in our cities but across the world, how do we become human beings? How do we take another leap in our evolution as human beings?
You are a Chinese-American woman. Your father ran a Chinese restaurant not far from here in Times Square in New York. How, and you graduated in 1935, got your PhD in 1940 from Bryn Mawr. How did you end up getting involved with black radical politics?
Well, the story, I think folks have to understand that, first of all, in 1940, when I got my PhD, Chinese Americans couldn't even get jobs in department stores. They would come right out, say, Macy's would come right out and say, we don't hire Orientals. And it was under those circumstances, when the question of race was so primary in this country, that I was looking for a job, not thinking it was ridiculous to think I might get one at a university, began to find a way to make links with the black movement, especially through the March on Washington movement, which was led by A. Philip Randolph in 1941. I decided I wanted to make movement politics my life at that time. It's been my life for the last 65 years.
1941. I don't think people know about a March on Washington, or certainly don't know who A. Philip Randolph is.
I know. And really, I'm not, I think, and maybe it's important to know, because up to 1941 and the March on Washington movement, which was led by A. Philip Randolph, who was the founder of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, blacks were not able to get the kinds of jobs that would provide them with any security, with any seniority. The defense plants, I mean, the Depression in 1940 had ended for white workers because the war production was booming, but not for black workers. And it was under those circumstances that the movement of blacks to get jobs, which was took the form of the challenge of the projection of a March on Washington, which scared Franklin D. Roosevelt to death. He was forced to issue Executive Order 8802, that we began to have a black working class. And then very soon, because the technology of World War II was introduced to the plant, that future began to close down for black young people. And I think it's necessary to understand that the first rebellion took place in Watts in 1965, in August 1965, shortly after the signing of the Civil Voting Rights Bill, which came out of Selma. And Martin, a few days after that, the Watts erupted, and Martin Luther King went to Watts, found that the kids had no idea what he had been doing, and they were very proud that they had erupted and forced people to recognize that they existed. And in response to that, King moved to Chicago in 1966 to listen to these young people. And he came to the conclusion at the end of his life that what we needed was to listen to them and understand that the age of just expanding economically and technologically had come to an end, or we needed to bring it to an end, and understand how it had created and had destroyed community and denied participation to so many people. And so we were at a watershed in human history, and that's where we are today. And I think that's the context in which we have to look at what happened in 67.
I'd like to ask you in relationship to when you say that the young people were proud of the fact that they'd forced recognition of themselves, the role of the media, of the news media, In terms of the Kerner Commission, obviously, after Detroit and Newark, said that they blamed the media for, one, failing to at all deal with racism in American society, but also found instances where reporters actually fabricated violent events during the rebellions to make things look even worse than what they were. Your analysis of the media's impact on public consciousness.
But they were pretty bad. I think if not to acknowledge that they were pretty bad, I'm just thinking, for example, Mack Avenue up the street from where I live. Before the rebellion, we had a whole lot of small stores, drug stores, hardware stores, small restaurants. Now it's a complete wasteland. And many sections of the city were looted and burned. I mean, it was a very difficult and painful period. But out of the pain, what we got out of the pain was a kind of black political power within the cities. But the blacks who came to power in the cities had the same sort of institutions to administer. So it wasn't a question of changing from white to black, but changing the whole infrastructure, because the rebellions represented this cry from young people to be of use in some way, to have a society in which, instead of being outsiders, they were part and parcel of belonging and creating and being of use.
Amiri, what has changed in these 40 years in terms of consciousness and in terms of what the country has learned from that period?
Well, actually, in some ways, we've gone full cycle, but up to another level. I mean, we went from the kind of blatant brutalization of white supremacy and racism. We then organized ourselves and elected two black mayors. None of my children, for instance, have ever grown under white people ruling in Newark. They don't even know what that is, you understand? And so we can be proud of that. But at the same time, after we had our two domestic kind of mayors who compromise relentlessly with corporate power. You understand? Now we've come full circle.
Let me ask you a question, Amir. Yeah. Do you think that we have challenged and criticized and evaluated black power sufficiently?
Have we? No. No, but I've been doing it for...
When are we going to do it?
Well, I've been doing it for almost 37 years. I mean, having two black mayors there, Sharp James and Ken Gibson, I was probably their most relentless critic all the time. But now we have somebody who doesn't compromise with corporate power, but who represents it. So that's the difference.
Well, do you think it's a question of changing an individual, you know, from Gibson to Booker?
The system. You have to get an individual who's willing to actually struggle with the system to change it. As long as you have people who...
I mean, what do we mean by struggling with the system?
To make substantive changes, to make infrastructure changes.
When are we going to understand that we have to create new infrastructures?
Yeah, but you can only do that through people, you see.
But you're not going to do it from people at the top. We're going to do it from people at the
bottom. You have to mobilize the whole community, but what I'm saying is the people top became accommodated to being in power
But you see, we put so much emphasis on taking over the power structure, and we became prisoners of it.
Because I'm going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue the discussion after the show, and then we'll broadcast that. I want to thank you so much for being with us, Grace Lee Boggs, Amiri Baraka, and Larry Hamm. Our website to get a copy of today's broadcast, this historic meeting of the minds, is democracynow.org. Fond farewell to Nick Marsilio. Thank you so much to Sharif Abdo-Kadous and to Jeffrey Hagerman. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.